Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We'll get to our scheduled conversation about ICE and Border Patrol and enforcement activities in Charlotte and around the state in just a moment. But first, the announcement late yesterday that Dr. Crystal Hill will return to her job as superintendent of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools this very morning. WFAE's education reporter James Farrell joins us now. And Hill was placed on suspension with pay on June 17th. James, at the time, we were given no reason as to why. We understand that Dr. Hill was also in the dark about that. What did school board officials say about the reasons for putting her on suspension as they announced the end of the investigation into her and the return of Dr. Hill to her position?
Yes, so the board still has not provided any information specifically about what it was that prompted this investigation or why they put her on leave. Last night, they repeated the same thing that they had said, which was that they were looking into issues involving district operations and oversight and administrative oversight. So that's kind of a broad net and can kind of mean a lot of different things. We have not gotten more specific than that. Last night, they said that the investigation found issues as it relates to leadership and operational practice, but that those and that they would require ongoing attention, but that they would address that directly with Dr. Hill herself. And they did decline to get into any more specifics about what that meant.
That was a statement from CMS, and Stephanie Sneed, the school board chair, I think issued that statement. She added that the board believes that returning Dr. Hill to her position provides the best pathway forward for CMS, for a superintendent who has always been heaped on with great praise, whose contract was extended just last year, and who got a raise which went into effect during her paid suspension. That seems like a weak endorsement, is it?
Yeah. Well, the whole thing has been very kind of a convoluted and strange story to follow because, like you said, Mike, just in December, they extended this contract and gave this raise, and that raise took effect during this leave. Just last year, we had the test results that everyone was praising as historic, and up until the budget process in April, we really didn't have a great sense of any major tensions bubbling between the board and Hill. Obviously, that budget process exposed some tensions and some friction there, and there were some heated conversations that came from that. But without knowing what the nature of the allegations that they received, which have still not been disclosed, it's tough to kind of parse through where the relationship between Hill and the board stands right now, only that somehow they intend to continue working together despite all that's happened.
So yesterday, the school board met, I think, in closed session for several hours and then released this statement, of part of which we have quoted here. And then the school board chair Stephanie Sneed, and the rest of the board, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, because you were there, met with the media. What did they or did she add, if anything, to that statement? And did she take questions?
Yes, she did take questions. Reporters pressed her a lot on kind of what happened in closed doors. We were asking a lot of questions about whether there was any kind of a vote and if the vote had been unanimous or what the count of the vote was in order to bring Hill back. Sneed declined to answer any of those questions or to specify the vote. She said something along the lines of, you know, regardless of whether it was unanimous, we all kind of stand together now, moving forward from this. She didn't add too much more. She said again that this was a personnel matter, and as a personnel matter, they couldn't disclose the specific allegations. She clarified that Dr. Hill would be back at work starting today. So as of today, Hill is back at work. She'll be here for the first day of school in a couple of weeks. She said that they had every confidence that they'd be able to work with her still. Otherwise, she would not have been able to return to work. So kind of some new statements, but not any new details.
Well, will she be able to work with this board and they with her? I mean, this on the one hand, this could be viewed as embarrassing. If you were in Dr. Hill's position, this whole investigation might be embarrassing. Or maybe there's nothing we don't know because we don't know anything about what went on. But there certainly must be some mud in the water.
Right. I mean, I'm just guessing here, Mike, but the fact that she's returning to work as soon as today and that they made this decision makes me think that they've been communicating with her in some capacity. Again, that's just a guess, not based off of anyone I've spoken to or anything. But certainly, I mean, that's going to be the next thing that we watch. The next school board meeting is August 25th. That's going to be the first one with Hill back. I'm sure there'll be a lot of attention paid to the communication that they have and to what that tension looks like on stage, if any. You know, it's going to be interesting to see, especially because right now we don't know where the fault lines lie. Like I said,
Right.
this may have not been a unanimous decision. Certainly didn't sound unanimous from the way that they were not answering that question. So there's a question of, are there some school board members who were more in favor of this versus some who weren't? That's all stuff we're going to be paying attention to.
I mean, could this be a face-saving compromise on both sides of the equation? Let her come back, and while she's back, she's looking for another job.
I wish I could answer that, but it's hard to answer it without knowing still what this investigation was all about. And, you know, they continue to cite personnel matters as a reason for doing it, which makes sense to an extent. But there are some there's some wording in the statute there from the state statute that says that if it is involved in maintaining the integrity of the district, you can choose to disclose some of that. So that's going to have to be the debate that's had here to determine if it's in the public interest to hear more.
Well, you referenced this part of Sneed's statement saying that the investigation, quote, identified issues that will require ongoing attention as it relates to leadership and operational practice. And some of that does sound like a personnel issue, although it seems to me that if you're a public employee being paid by the taxpayers, your personnel file should be open, but that's a state law, it can't be. But it also seems because it's a personnel issue, we'll have difficulty in uncovering a lot of what went on. But it also sounds like information that taxpayers and parents and faculty and staff should know about. In fact, the statement referred to, quote, serious concerns involving district operations and oversight. That seems very public to me. How confident are you that we'll ever be told what this was all about?
I can't say that, but I can be confident in saying that that pressure is going to continue. I mean, this is not over yet. We've already filed a public records request for the findings. We'll see what happens there. I know that other outlets will continue to press on this. We'll continue to press board members. There's a lot of questions here that I know that the public still has, and a lot of uncertainty about what happened here. And certainly with the context of the fact that this is our seventh superintendent in 10 years, and there's
Yep.
been a lot of discourse about the constant turnover, there's going to be a real argument here that there is a public interest in at least understanding what it was that happened here. So I know that this story is not over yet. Questions are going to continue. Like I mentioned, we have the other school board meeting in August will be Dr. Hill's first back at the dais, so we'll have to see what happens there and what that dynamic looks like.
What, if anything, has Dr. Hill said about this decision?
She has not made any public statements that I'm aware of. I did try to reach out to her last night. I did not hear back. So no public statement from her at this point.
And have we confirmed that she is indeed back at work this morning?
I have not yet, but we were told last night that she would be back at work today.
So you referenced the fact that there has been, one would say, great instability at the school district over the last 10 or 15 years. She is the seventh school superintendent in 15 years. And yet the school board insists, quote, families can feel confident that CMS is ready for the new school year and that the people throughout this organization remain focused on serving your children every day. Given what we just went through and the secrecy surrounding it, why should parents be confident about anything at CMS?
I think that's a lot of questions that I'm hearing from parents and that I think a lot of parents have right now. And I think that that remains to be seen whether or not they can, you know, instill that confidence. One thing I'll say is I know that we do have test results being released in a couple of weeks from this past school year. CMS staff has hinted at those results being really positive. That could be a rallying point, maybe something that they are able to coalesce around. It could also be an opportunity for Hill to kind of take a victory lap if the results are positive. So that could be something to watch as well. And obviously, when test scores are good, that helps inspire confidence, but we'll have to see what those actually end up looking at.
Well, go dig up some information. James Farrell, WFAE's education reporter, thank you for joining us this morning. I appreciate it.
You got it. Thanks, Mike.
So on to our original topic. Last fall, Border Patrol and enforcement concentrated their deportation efforts on several major cities, among them Chicago, Los Angeles, New Orleans, and Charlotte. The Trump administration claimed it was going after the worst of the worst, violent criminals who came here illegally into this country as criminals and who continued their criminal activity while here. That may have been true in a few, but not in most of the cases so far that we know about. What unfolded was the targeting of individuals largely due to the color of their skin, the language they spoke, and areas of town in which they were found. They were rounded up, denied due process, sent to detention areas, and often deported. There's a story in the New York Times this morning about people being deported to countries they don't even know where they are. They are incarcerated. They have no access to legal aid. They have no way of getting out. All this happened in Charlotte around Thanksgiving. It's over now, right? Well, no, it's not. Those efforts continue, though a bit less dramatically. Last month, Carolina Migrant Network, which offers immigration legal assistance, received more than 30 calls to a hotline in just a two-week period. So today, an update on who is being arrested, what this means for our already overburdened jails, and its impact on the immigrant community here and around the state, because these activities are happening here and around the state as well, particularly in western North Carolina, which we'll talk about in a moment. Julian Berger is WFAE's race and equity reporter. He's here with Stephanie Arteaga, co-director of the Carolina Migrant Network, and Lily Knepp is senior Western North Carolina reporter for NC Local. Julian, very quickly, remind us how long Operation Charlotte's Web lasted and how many people were arrested as a result.
Yeah, Operation Charlotte's Web was about 5 days to a week long, and close to 400 people were detained in the operation.
So, Lily, NC Local reports that ICE data released this spring shows that 6,374 people have been arrested in North Carolina under the Trump administration mass deportation effort. The highest number of people arrested was in Mecklenburg County. Do you know how that number has grown since April?
Thanks, Mike. Yeah, that's from reporting from Jacob Biba, who's one of our other reporters at NC Local. We have not gotten any updates from that investigation. NC Local actually has a lawsuit against the Homeland Security Department to try and find out what happened to the folks who were arrested within ICE and try to get some more details, because it has been a little scarce.
So six people, Stephanie, that we know of, six people have died as a result of Border Patrol operations nationwide. But after the most recent incidences in Minneapolis in January, things seem to have quieted down nationally. And in Charlotte, we haven't heard much about these operations since last November. But is not hearing about these operations an accurate reflection of what's actually happening?
Thanks, Mike. That's a great question. Currently, we are projecting to have the deadliest year to date under the Trump administration. We've had 52 people die. And just a couple of weeks ago, we had a young man, 29-year-old from Durham, pass away from leukemia complications at the Stewart Detention Center, who was coughing up blood, and ICE decided to discharge him and he ended up passing away 3 days later. So though we're not necessarily seeing the numbers so broadly, these incidents are happening, and we're concerned that people are dying at an average rate of one death a week at this point under this administration. And just to put it into perspective, under the Biden administration, all 4 years, only 26 people died. So far, we're at 54.
So 54 is the number of people in custody who have died. Does that number include the six people that we know were shot and killed in the course of activities on the streets of Minneapolis and other cities around the country?
Yes, that's correct.
That includes that number. Okay. When we come back, I want to talk about the fact that the Trump administration says that they have scaled back the use of routine traffic stops nationwide. Has that in fact been the case here? And we'll look into other aspects of this as we go through the rest of the hour here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about ICE activities here and around the state. Julian Berger's with us, our race and equity reporter at WFAE News. Stephanie Arteaga is co-director of the Carolina Migrant Network. And Lily Knipp is senior Western North Carolina reporter for NC Local. Julian, you recently reported that the Trump administration has ordered U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents to scale back their use of traffic stops nationwide. That was in mid-July. As far as you can tell, has that happened here?
Yeah, so I published that article, and then a couple days later, Trump and the Trump administration reversed that. And they actually said, oh, traffic stops can continue, and they should continue. And so in Charlotte, we have seen that traffic stops as well as chases throughout the city of Charlotte to seek immigrants have continued to happen.
So Stephanie, the Carolina Migrant Network, about that same time that report came out, reported about, I think, 30 calls to your hotline, which has been set up to offer immigration legal assistance. How since last November, when Operation Charlotte's Web took place, how would you describe the need for that assistance? What are these people calling for help on?
Yeah, so the need just continues to grow. We have been seeing more calls for people who are being detained primarily in traffic stops. Mm-hmm. And that is something that seems consistent across the nation. We know that the administration is moving from doing flashy operations like we saw last November to really targeting individuals in their cars. We know that racial profiling is playing a big role in this situation. And unfortunately, in North Carolina, we have the only immigration attorney that's representing people on immigration bond in the state and in South Carolina as well. So we just don't have the capacity to really meet the need.
During Operation Charlotte's Web and other similar operations in cities like Minneapolis and Chicago, it was often difficult for relatives to determine the fate of the individuals who had been apprehended and detained. It was reported that detainees have been denied access to lawyers, to their family, through phone calls, etc., and often due process. Has that changed in any way?
No, we're still continuing to see the same tactics to limit access to attorneys, limit access to communication. We're now also hearing reports that when people are falling ill, instead of calling EMS, they're trying to charge the families to send them to medical facilities. If anything, we're seeing less and less access to basic necessities.
NC Local, Lily, has a counter on its website. And as of this morning, it has been 267 days since NC Local requested data from the federal government on detained people in North Carolina. That includes requests for information on those rounded up during Charlotte Web operations last November. What response have you gotten at all?
We have heard back from the federal government in June, and they denied our request. That's after, you know, a back and forth with our lawyers. And so we are now waiting on that next step. That lawsuit also includes a request for body cam footage from Operation Charlotte's Web. So.
And some people who don't like the media will say, well, you don't need that information. But in fact, your publication points out that the U.S. government has a legal obligation to keep public records open and accessible to taxpayers, which would include members of the media. And your publication has filed a lawsuit. They did it in June to get information, which you say isn't yours, but ours as taxpayers. Where does that stand?
That's that lawsuit that I was referring to. We filed that in, and we have heard back that they will be denying that. And so we will be continuing to move forward with that.
So, Julian, during Operation Charlotte's Web and other similar operations around the country, the tactics used by ICE seem to be, to the average person, draconian. Unmarked vehicles roaming the streets, masked ICE officials with no badges or any other identification, chasing down people on foot, also stopping vehicles, often breaking their windows to drag people out and put them on the ground, and many people were shocked. That seemed relatively un-American to most people. Have those tactics changed?
No, those tactics continue to be the same. We saw last month In one of the traffic stops on South Boulevard, that a man's car window was shattered as they were trying to get him out. So we're still seeing windows shattered. Like I mentioned, there was a car chase last week in South Charlotte as well. I've been trying to get more information about that. The car chase ended in a car accident, and the man that they were trying to chase was taken to the hospital with injuries. So we're still seeing these brutal and harsh tactics being played out with ICE, regarding, and it doesn't even have to be CBP. We're seeing it now with ICE.
Earlier in these operations here and around the country, it seemed to be very random. They would spot somebody who was speaking Spanish, or they would spot somebody whose skin was a darker shade than white, or they were in a neighborhood that was known to be a Hispanic area, and they would simply stop them or chase them down. Shortly after the Trump administration allegedly ordered ICE to scale back their use of routine traffic stops, ICE said it planned to limit vehicle stops to people considered its highest priority targets. This has been alluded to already this morning, with those with serious or violent criminal histories. But that's also what we were told prior to and during Operation Charlotte's Web, that they were going after the worst of the worst, and we know that to be not true. So how is what's happening now different from what happened before? How do they determine the status of the individuals they are apprehending in these traffic stops, Julian?
Well, ICE, there was a piece that came out last week from News Nation saying that ICE is targeting, like you said, the worst of the worst, and that they have specific names that they're going after. But like we have said, we don't know what to take as truth. We don't know what's true, what's not true, and they could still be racially profiling. We just don't know.
But have they explained how they determine who they stop?
Not that I know of.
Last month, you also reported on two Charlotte women who are seeking more than $2.5 million in damages from the federal government for alleging that ICE agents unlawfully detained and arrested them during Operation Charlotte Web in this city last fall. They say that they were following and documenting the activities of immigration agents in East Charlotte when agents boxed in their SUV, pointed guns at them, shattered the vehicle's window, and arrested them. They were charged with assaulting a federal officer and held for 4 hours before being released. But a video of that incident went viral. What does it show?
Yeah, so it shows CBP basically chasing them, leading them on a chase and boxing them in, and then pointing guns at them, shattering their car windows and arresting them. So like we've been mentioning throughout the show, brutal tactics that
Does it
they're now trying.
show them assaulting an officer?
No, it doesn't. No,
Is
it
there any
doesn't.
evidence that they did, in fact, maybe off camera, assault an officer?
Not that I know of. No.
They also say that the agents violated their constitutional rights while they were observing and documenting agents' activities. Has this kind of activity continued? Are they still going after people who are pulling out their cell phones and taping?
Not that I know of, Stefania. I'm not sure if you have an answer on that.
I will say, as far as, and I kind of wanted to go back and answer your question in terms of their tactics. What we're seeing is that because immigration enforcement is civil in nature, they don't necessarily have the right to detain people on the streets or enter into people's homes with administrative warrants that are just signed by ICE agents. And so what we're seeing really is our tactics to confuse people that they're, one, they're local law enforcement and are conducting traffic citations, which is really, really concerning, especially for local law enforcement who are trying to build trust in the community. And two, I think it goes into the same situation we're seeing where they're trying to portray this narrative of the criminal immigrant, which is not realistic to the numbers or that we're seeing, and also their definition of who is a criminal as well. But you know, we also have verifiers who go out into the community and spot ICE activity, and we have seen very aggressive behavior when people are documenting ICE enforcement in the city.
Stephanie, Julian just referenced News Nation, which is a streaming news network, and they say that Charlotte is a major target in the Trump administration's immigration crackdown. They repeated the claim that ICE is now going after the worst of the worst. They went along on a ride with ICE, I believe, in Charlotte. They reported on several arrests of people with documented criminal pasts, including the arrest of a man who had an Interpol red notice out of Ecuador for the rape of a child. News Nation quoted ICE Assistant Field Director Steve Kemmerling as saying, quote, "We're very much dialed in to these specific individuals," meaning that these are targeted, one would presume, rather than random. In at least one instance, they came armed with a warrant. I don't know whether that was a warrant signed by a judge or whether it was, as you referred to a moment ago, simply a warrant that they signed, ICE signed. Is this an indication that the tactics and the procedures are, in fact, in some way changing? Are you noticing a change in approach here?
No, and on, quite honestly, based on the very limited amount of data that we can see through, for example, track from Syracuse University that tracks ICE enforcement, the data does not back up that people who are being detained have criminal records. And I was looking at some numbers, and we're looking at a very small number of individuals who have had contact with law enforcement. And I also want to add, like, the definition of coming into contact with law enforcement for ICE is quite broad. It means people who have been charged and not convicted. And so it's really difficult when we're hearing very misguiding information from the federal government, and is trying to create this narrative on who immigrants are that is not realistic with the truth, and hence why we're not seeing data. And so I think we should all be concerned that our government is lying to us.
And ICE is also expanding operations to airports around the country, reportedly approaching travelers at check-in counters, even at the boarding gates, allegedly targeting those who have overstayed their visas, including the spouses of American citizens. Julian, has that been happening at Charlotte Douglas?
Yeah, so Queen City News, they reported that there would have been at least two immigration-related arrests at the Charlotte airport. But other than that, I haven't seen anything else related to that.
I'm not sure who to ask this question of. What are the laws surrounding foreign nationals with or without current visas who are married to American citizens? Are they vulnerable? And has that always been the case? Or if you are married to somebody who is an American citizen, you're allowed to stay?
I'm not an attorney,
Stephanie.
but what I can say is that if somebody is married to a US citizen, there are potential pathways to be able to adjust your status and get permanent residency. I also just want to note that being in the US without status is a civil offense. It is not a criminal offense. Hence, again, this wordplay, this narrative that we're hearing from the Trump administration. And I also just want to add, just a few days ago, there was actually a US citizen who was arrested by ICE agents in the Atlanta airport, which also just sounds the alarm bells around the lack of training that these agents have to really do their job because they're so numbers oriented. And the technology that's being used to surveil immigrants who are also providing false information on people's immigration status.
Julian, although CMPD says it does not participate in federal immigration enforcement operations, the TSA does. So what, because they're a federal agency, what has been the reaction in the immigrant community here in Charlotte to what's happening at airports?
Yeah, there's been a big question about whether people should fly recently, especially internationally. I mean, people that have visas, that have green cards, that are technically legally able to fly nationally and internationally, there's been a big concern of, gosh, if I go back, let's say, to Mexico for vacation to visit my family, will I be able to come back into the US despite having a visa, a green card, having all the correct documents? So that's a big concern that I've been hearing in the immigrant community, and immigration lawyers have been saying, yes, you can fly, you're okay, but there's still that big concern that something could happen when they return.
So, despite the fact that we're not seeing ICE operations splashed all over television every day, Lily, they are continuing, and they are continuing statewide. And in the western part of the state, which is your territory, ICE agents are looking in a new place, our national forests. You reported last week that a popular swimming hole in the Pisgah National Forest was the site of an ICE operation in July, which you say originated in a request from Forest Service law enforcement. Explain that.
Yeah, so this feels unique and new in North Carolina, that ICE is, you know, working with the Forest Service as a federal agency, but we haven't really seen before an ICE operation in national forests. So what happened was ICE says that the Forest Service reached out to them and they ended up setting up a checkpoint at this really popular swimming spot that is especially popular with Latino families, and began to investigate people's licenses and check in on that.
Why would National Forest law enforcement or Forest Service law enforcement make that request?
It's unclear at this time. I talked to the Forest Service and got some statements from them. They said that they were working with local law enforcement and federal law enforcement to, you know, continue to keep the local forests safe. But this is something that we really haven't seen before.
If they are law enforcement, the Forest Service law enforcement, and they have a concern about the individuals at this swimming hole in the Pisgah National Forest, why didn't they make the arrests themselves?
The Forest Service doesn't have immigration authority, is my understanding. And so that would be the ICE says that's why they reached out to the Forest Service. This is, you know, a really popular spot with the Latino community. I talked to a local nonprofit who runs a Latinos Adventureros organization, as they actually do cleanups at this spot and do a lot of community work there, trying to help, you know, translate signs to make sure people are swimming in safe spots. And she said she really felt like this was a slap in the face and was just a shift in that relationship with the Forest
Caldwell
Service.
County Sheriff's Office was also asked by the Forest Service to get involved in this operation. In what way, and did the Sheriff's Office comply?
Yes, they did. They were a part of that traffic stop, from what we understand. They set up a checkpoint at the beginning of the road going to this swimming spot. And it seems like the law enforcement kind of stayed up at the road. And as folks, you know, heard that law enforcement was there and were trying to leave, going to their cars, that's when they were intercepted by local law enforcement and ICE and asked about their legal status. And 13 people were actually detained and arrested that day.
And what has happened to those 13 people?
We don't know. I have heard from community members that at least a few people have been released, but otherwise, we're not sure.
We have more to find out about these activities in Western North Carolina, and there's something going on in Eastern North Carolina that people should know about if they're not aware of it, and we'll talk about that as well when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and United Way of Greater Charlotte. Celebrating 95 years, United Way of Greater Charlotte supports education, financial stability, health, and essential services. Details at UnitedWayGreaterCLT.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. We're talking about ICE activity in North Carolina. Julian Berger's here, our race and equity reporter for WFAE News. Stefania Arteaga is the co-director of the Carolina Migrant Network. And Lily Knepp is the senior Western North Carolina reporter for NC Local. We were talking just prior to the break about operations in the Pisgah National Forest involving ICE, the Forest Service law enforcement, and the Caldwell County Sheriff's Office, where they arrested 13 people, you said, who were allegedly in the country illegally during an operation. What do we know about those arrested? Were they, in fact, people with criminal records? Were they the worst of the worst?
I mean, that's been the issue with all, I think, all of our conversations, is when you don't share the names of the people that have been detained, it's hard for reporters to go and check and make sure if these people have criminal charges or not. The people whose names have been shared with us by community members and Siembra, who also works in the region, has gotten some names. We have not been able to confirm if they have criminal records or not.
So there are reports, and maybe you mentioned this earlier, I can't remember, that family members of those arrested in this struggled to locate their detained relatives. Do you know the status of those individuals today? Do you know where they are being held? Do you know if they have accessed the legal representation?
ICE told me that that folks had been taken to the Georgia Detention Center, but recently I spoke to a community member. They said a few people had been released and let go. So, yeah.
And how has this impacted the immigrant community in Western North Carolina?
I think there's a lot of fear. I think, as I mentioned, this is not something that we're used to in Western North Carolina. This is the first time in anyone's recent memory in the last, more than 5 years of an operation happening in National Forest. I talked to a community member who went out to this swimming hole at Wilson's Creek, and they said that it was there were not any Latino families last weekend. So I think people feel, concerned about this happening
Wherever
again.
these operations, unfold, there is fear, clearly, in the immigrant community, and that impacts the economy. And Western North Carolina is struggling to recover from Hurricane Helene and restore their economy to pre-Helene, status. And a lot of these individuals contribute mightily to that economy. Can you calculate what this has meant to businesses in that area?
I think it's hard to calculate. A lot of these folks maybe are driving up from across the region to come to this swimming spot. So that's, bringing funds, but maybe folks aren't going to restaurants. But I think it is inhib making folks want to stay home. Like we're talking about, there's been traffic stops and at swimming holes.
So was this the first time that the Forest Service requested help from ICE in your part of the world, or from the Sheriff's Department? Was this the first time that the Caldwell County Sheriff actually joined forces with ICE, or is this something that's ongoing?
As far as we know, this was the first time that this has happened. I have filed public records requests and I'm looking back at that history, but this seems like the first time this has happened.
Stephanie of the Caldwell County Sheriff's Department signed on to the 287G agreement with ICE in 2020, which allows certain local officers to perform limited federal immigration enforcement duties under ICE supervision. 25 law enforcement agencies in the state have 287G agreements. Mecklenburg County is not one of them. What are you hearing about the prevalence and the success of ICE activities in the counties that do have these agreements?
We've seen, so it's just also to give some context, the reason why counties need to enter into these 287G agreements is because sheriffs and any law enforcement agency has purview over criminal, state, and federal law, not civil immigration law. And so through these contracts is how the Department of Homeland Security essentially makes them an extension of ICE agents. And so in Mecklenburg County, we had a 287G program for 12 years, and we have a lot of data that has shown from, extremely low birth rates for Latino moms to evident lack of healthcare access from children as well, because parents were fearful of going to the doctor. This is something we keep on seeing in these counties. What's interesting about this as well is because even though the feds are deputizing sheriffs to hold people for ICE, we don't have the capacity nor the funding in these counties to be able to do so for ICE because people are coming in under XYZ criminal violations or citations, and they may be released after getting bond, or their charges may be dropped. And instead of doing so, they're being held for an additional 48 hours for ICE. And that does not mean that ICE will pick them up. We have over 100 counties in North Carolina. I don't know exactly the number where we're at right now, but it's probably about 30 or so that have these agreements. It's impossible for one field office to go around the state picking people up.
So let's talk about one of the impacts of this and other aspects of overcrowding of our jails. Sheriffs around the state warned Julian that Irina's Law, which was passed in the aftermath of the murder of Irina Zarutska on the Charlotte Blue Line last winter, that law limits pretrial release for certain defendants, which means they stay in jail, which is now straining jail capacity. More than a third of North Carolina jails have exceeded capacity at some point during this past year. Here in Mecklenburg in July, 2,146 people were in custody in Mecklenburg County's Uptown Jail. That's 242 people over capacity. Sheriff McFadden says that pods designed for 53 people now house about 84 people, and that jails around the state, as Stephanie has alluded to, hundreds of people are now sleeping on the floor in these jails. How is that situation exacerbated by ICE arrests and the fact that they have to be detained longer until ICE comes and get them? How is that, what is that adding to this overcrowding problem, Julia?
Yeah, so with House Bill 318, it now requires sheriffs to hold undocumented immigrants, people that they aren't able to verify their legal status, for 48 hours past the date that they're able to be released once they post bond. And that is apparently supposed to allow ICE to pick up these people if they aren't able to verify their immigration status. So this has, it exacerbated the overcrowding. I think Irina's Law has done it even more so than House Bill 318, but it has had some impact.
And most recently,
go ahead.
We just had Senate Bill 153 passed that will now mandate contractual agreements between state troopers, the SBI, the Bureau of Corrections. And so now we're seeing basically a deputized force that will be increased across law enforcement to also partake in civil immigration.
Because although sheriff's departments and police departments are not forced to cooperate, state law enforcement agencies are by law now.
Well, through House Bill 318, in a way, they are mandated to do so. So you have basically a force multiplier through that bill as well.
Okay. The New York Times is reporting on activity at the long-dormant Rivers Correctional Institution in Winton in northeastern North Carolina near the Virginia border. Workers there evidently are upfitting that facility. It's been closed for a couple of years. They're upfitting it to become a 1,400-bed detention facility to be used by ICE. It would be the first migrant detention center in the state and the largest detention center on the East Coast. This is a privately owned prison. It's owned by the GEO Group, which has been partnering with the federal government to repurpose several prison facilities that they own and operate around the country and make them detention centers. Julian, is that an aspect of this that hasn't been explored? Funneling federal dollars into private organizations to hold illegal immigrants for profit?
No, that's been something that we've been seeing this past year. There's been speculations that ICE could put a detention center in Concord. They could put a detention center in Greensboro. And then now Winton, North Carolina. That's been something that's been speculating for months. And now we finally got confirmed.
But are these other facilities that you're alluding to, would they be government operated or would they be privately owned facilities that the government is paying them to operate at a profit?
Privately owned. Yep.
So given recent laws passed by North Carolina's Republican legislature that require state law enforcement agencies to cooperate with ICE, is this added capacity likely to be greatly needed and maybe even in fact become overcrowded itself over a short amount of time? Julian, do we know?
Not that we know of. I'm not sure if this new bill is connected to this new detention center being planned.
So, Stephanie, you have pointed out that this facility in Winton is poised to make our state a major hub for ICE detentions on the East Coast. What are your concerns about that?
Well, Through public records requests that the ACLU was able to obtain, we know that the Winton facility was selected because of its proximity to Richmond. Maryland does not have detention centers. Virginia does have two, but collectively with a max capacity of 1,000. And so we know that part of ICE's tactic is moving people to rural communities away from families and attorneys and moving them further south, which is where a lot of their deportation sites are in Texas and Louisiana. And so there's a lot of concern of what it will mean to that to bus people from the region. We also still have a lot of unanswered questions. We don't know what court will have jurisdiction over this facility. We also know that it is very likely, because we are averaging one death in detention a week, that upon opening, it is very likely this year we will see a death in North Carolina.
This prison in Winton has been closed for a while, and now they're bringing it back. And Winton, I'm told that, like much some other parts of eastern North Carolina, has fallen on hard times. There are a lot of empty stores on their main street, etc. Will this be an employment driver for that area? Will it increase the fortunes of the people living in that area, or will it simply be a big prison again? That is looming large over Main Street.
Yeah, what we've seen in places like Lumpkin, Georgia, where the Stewart Detention Center is, where most of North Carolinians are sent to, is that they do rely on locals for their staffing, but that doesn't necessarily mean people are making a lot of money. We're still seeing very low wages in very poor communities, and this is likely to be the case here in Winton as well. I will note that GEO did mention that they're estimating $80 million of profit. This is profit that they are going to be making off of people's bodies. We do have a quota. Our federal government does have a quota on the amount of people that they want in detention centers, and there's a whole economy that revolves around that. So that is not necessarily money that will stay in Winton, North Carolina.
Did you want to chime in on that, Lily?
One of our other reporters at NC Local, Ryan Orley, is actually working on a story about the community impact of reopening this prison in Winton. So he's spent the last few days on the ground there, going to some of these businesses and talking with the mayor and the town board. And I think Stefania is absolutely correct, as this line between how the reaction to having this sort of a prison in town, and what it will mean for this prison to be reopened in this community.
The Biden administration closed the Rivers Correctional Institution in 2021. It was part of a phasing out of the use of for-profit prisons by the federal government. At the time, the prison had a history of poor and really dangerous conditions for the inmates and, by extension, I guess, the guards. From what we know of conditions in other ICE detainment facilities, is that likely to be true? When this place reopens, Stefania, will ICE be concerned about poor conditions, or will they view that as a feature?
So I don't think ICE really cares what happens to people who are detained there. I will also say one of the trends that we have been seeing through talking to partners across the country is that in facilities that are reopening or facilities that are being newly opened, is that their GEO and corporations alike are speech fast tracking applications of folks who have had prior employment with similar infrastructures. And so what we're seeing is, again, same situation as we're seeing in the federal government: very little oversight, very little training, and very little anything really to make sure that standards are upheld.
And with the lack of transparency that permeates the operations of ICE, etc., evidently people in Hertford County, which is the home county of Winton, are concerned over that because they don't know precisely what is being planned, and it's been very difficult for them to get information about what is being planned. Why would that be? Why would that be secret?
Well, we're talking about a for-profit organization. I think that's part of the strategy the federal government is relying on. They are giving funds, our taxpayer dollars, to private corporations that are not going to have to really respond right away
But this is the
around.
most transparent administration in the history of the country, according to Donald Trump. So why would that not be front and center? Here's what's going on.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's what we're all wondering, right? How transparent they are. And I honestly, it is very concerning. We've seen a lot of folks in local small towns who have be, are being transported for medical emergencies. Columbus, Georgia, I'm sorry, is the largest town next to the Lumpkin Detention Center. And it is being inundated by people who are being transferred out of the Stewart Detention Center immediately because of medical complications, bad food, lack of health care. And so that is likely to be the case in Winton. And we'll likely know more from community members than we will from the federal government or the jail facility itself.
Do you feel like you're making any progress on getting any information or getting more transparency from ICE operations and ICE operators, or are you spinning your wheels?
No. And I think it's up to us to really continue to put pressure on this administration and at all levels of government to ensure that we get answers.
Stephanie Artiega is the co-director of the Carolina Migrant Network. She joined us along with Lily Knepp, Western North Carolina reporter for NC Local, and WFAE's Julian Berger. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. Our intern is Emmy Berger. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to visit past episodes, or to sign up for the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.